I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Emily Gindelsberger lost her job as a senior staff writer at Philadelphia City Paper when it went out of business a few years ago. She'd written about what it was like to be an Uber driver, which had gotten some buzz, and was approached by a publisher to find out what it was like to work low-wage jobs. So she worked at an Amazon fulfillment center, at Convergys, a call center, and at McDonald's. This was nothing like her desk job. She logged 15 miles a day and more at Amazon, her every movement monitored and logged. The stress of competing with robots and computers and the physical pain were excruciating. The call center had a different kind of stress. One employee said it was like being a human punching bag. At McDonald's, the stress involved always being short-staffed, under surveillance, and working by Ray Kroc's mantra, if there's time to lean, there's time to clean. Joining us is Emily Gindelsberger, and her new book is On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Now, to put our conversation in context, keep this in mind. The Federal Reserve found that half of U.S. jobs pay less than $18.58 an hour, more than a third less than $15 an hour, and that the bottom half of the country has less wealth today than they did 20 years ago, adjusted for inflation. With that said, Emily Gindelsberger, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, and we especially want to hear from you if you have worked one of these low-wage jobs or you're working at one now, here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You begin with this phrase, in the weeds. What does that mean?
Well, In the Weeds was actually the working title of the book for quite a long time, as you might guess from the intro.
Sure.
But it sort of depends what in the weeds means on kind of your social status and whether you've actually worked low-wage jobs, specifically in the service industry and food service. So in the weeds, when I learned it from waitresses when I was scooping ice cream, and it meant get out of my way. I have too much work to do. I have way more to do than I can do to keep my head above water. So, like, you know, get out of my way.
Right.
And then when I went to the Daily News, I found out, like, I would say I was in the weeds and I couldn't do something and people would be confused because it doesn't mean the same thing. In sort of the more white-collar academic world, it means you're stuck in the details of a story or of a paper or something. And the disconnect between these two definitions, I think, is a pretty good metaphor for the disconnect between the experience of work.
Well, I think a lot of people would say, I have a stressful job. I feel the demands of my employer, the demands of productivity, all of that. How is the stress of low-wage work, though, different from work where people are actually paid a pretty good wage and have pretty good benefits?
I'd say it's probably just dignity. And there's, I think, less constant monitoring. But there's just something extremely, it really wears on you to constantly have this, you know, digital monitor always over your shoulder, always looking at you, always timing you. It makes you feel like a robot, honestly. It makes you feel like they don't think of you as human.
Well, in fact, that's one of the things that really struck me is you describing your work at these three different places and always, in a sense, being on the clock, always being monitored, bathroom checks, when you arrived, when you left. Every simple movement seemed to be monitored.
Yes, definitely. It was especially at the Amazon warehouse was the most obvious example of that, in that when I was a picker, and so that meant I walked around this huge, like, infinite-looking warren of shelving, finding items that people had ordered and putting them in a bin and then sending them off to packing. And I did this using a handheld scanner. And every task I did was broken down into, like, little subtasks. And every time you finished one of those subtasks, it would immediately give you another one. And then this bar at the bottom would start ticking down the seconds that you had remaining to do that task. And it was like that, just a chain of that all day long. For My shift was 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m.
So a 12-hour shift. I mean, were you?
It was 11 and a half. 11, yeah, okay. Unpaid lunch.
I got you. But at the same time, were you running? I mean, I think for people that have ordered from Amazon, and of course many people do that, are you running from one object to another to throw into that bin?
I never really had to run because actually honestly, just all the walking put me in a lot of pain, and I don't think I would have been able to run, frankly. But, you know, I was walking at a pretty quick pace, faster than I usually walk around the city, and it's just how constant it was.
This is, as you described, a 25-acre, is that correct? 25-acre warehouse?
Yeah, I believe it was 30 if you include the truck bay.
Okay, so, and more than 2.5 million square feet. So this is a giant warehouse filled with stuff that Americans buy.
Absolutely. It was incredible looking. Like, I was just dumbstruck the first time I saw it. Honestly, it's incredibly cool looking. There were all these conveyor belts where all these yellow totes, like, go along. You know, they're crisscrossing. It looks like something out of Dr. Seuss to me. And it's just enormous. Like, when you get out into the shelving system, you can just look any direction, and it looks like an M.C. Escher thing. Like, you just cannot see the end of the shelves.
Oh, the Escher, like the sort of 3D spatial distortion?
Yeah, it's just like you look and it doesn't seem real that the aisle could go on that long.
Now, you were there in part for a job, I mean, to write this book, to understand what it was like to work there. And you worked there a couple of months. It was before Christmas or around Christmas time. So obviously,
I worked there for most of the month of December. I interviewed for the job in November, I believe, and started on December 2nd was my orientation.
So we're talking Christmas season.
Yes, definitely.
What is it like for the people that you met there? And they many of them knew that you were there as a journalist, but at the same time, you were there temporarily. This is their job. How do they view their job?
It was sort of hard to find a lot of people who had been there for a long time, honestly. Most of the people I talked to had been there for under a year. I think it just – I'm not going to speculate on why that is. But, yeah, like, so you got to take it with a grain of salt, given that they have not been there for more than a year. But a lot of people – a lot of people found it painful. A lot of people frustrating. A lot of people really disliked being treated like a robot. That's a phrase that came up just naturally with people a lot. But what surprised me was people did kind of regard it as a good job compared to what else you could get in sort of like Southern Indiana. One of the people that I talked to, who appears in the book, drove an hour each way from her town for that, you know, 10, 15 hour or whatever she had, just because it was the hour each way was worth it because it paid so much better than the gas station or the pizza place.
What did it pay?
Mine was 10.50 an hour, and I believe I got a bonus of $1 an hour for sticking around through Christmas.
So just a little bit above minimum wage. But that was enough for people to drive, as you say, for at least this one employee to drive an hour to what perhaps was considered a good job compared to others.
Yeah. This is the thing that I think has been a little misconceived about the book. This is not intended as an expose of Amazon. This isn't intended or Convergys or McDonald's. This is sort of looking at the system that those three companies are very good at. And they're very good at following sort of the incentives to sort of treat their workers like robots. They're just really good at it. But these conditions are the same anywhere. I don't know. I was talking to someone in my training group just randomly, and she said that she'd worked in the Caterpillar warehouse last summer down the road, and she was really happy at how many water coolers there were around the warehouse because she had passed out from heat stroke three times in the Caterpillar warehouse the previous year.
You do call these cyborg jobs, and on the one hand, it is about monitoring movements, and obviously that's about productivity. How many things can you put in a bin? It's also about using algorithms to figure out staffing. That was certainly true with McDonald's, right? To sort of figure out what someone's schedule is, and they may not be told that schedule until a day or so before they have to go to work.
Yeah. So algorithmic scheduling is one of the biggest, I think, problems for workers in fast food and retail specifically, because a lot of these places, especially big chains in particular, they figure out the schedule like using data from the past year, the past month, and the past week. So
about when they're busy and when they're not, right?
Yes, and then they schedule people around what their prediction of the busy hours are going to be. So A, that ends up with a lot of people with like completely weird and unpredictable shifts. There's something called a clopen, where
C-L-O-P-E-N,
yes,
right?
C-L-O-P-E-N, which it means somebody has scheduled you to both close late at night and then open early in the morning. So you only get like, you know, 3 or 4 hours to rest in between. I think when human managers were doing, you know, when I was a kid, they would make the schedule on paper, like a manager would sit in the back booth. And now I think those managers would be kind of embarrassed to do that to somebody that they worked with, that they would have to look in the eye every day. But when it's done, you know, completely on computer, it's not really your fault, I think. You're just like, I don't know, it's the computer. The computer tells me what to do.
You also describe, and this was particularly true at McDonald's, just the level of understaffing. I mean, it seemed like by design.
Yeah. It sort of feels as if, have you ever had like a service job?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been a waitress. I don't know. Does that count?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, when you, like, if you're down a couple people.
Sure.
Like, your day, you don't close the restaurant, but you do, you know, everybody's kind of miserable all day, right? So it's sort of as if someone at some point, I think probably in the 80s or 90s, started saying, like, well, if we don't close the restaurant and, like, they can work that hard, like, it's clear that they can because we don't have to close when the restaurant is understaffed, why don't we just, like, schedule them like that all the time? Hmm. Schedule the exact minimum of people that will not cause a customer revolt over, like, how long the line's gotten.
Although we're almost up in a rake here, but almost it sounds like at the McDonald's that you worked, which was in San Francisco, people would be screaming, open another register, because the lines were so long.
Yeah, like, that happened kind of a lot, especially, you know, during lunch rush. And there's just nothing you can do about it because, you know, there may be a register open, but it's not like we have someone, you know, in the freezer who can come out and work it.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Emily Gindelsberger is our guest. She's got a brand new book. In fact, it's out today. It's called On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. And again, she worked at Amazon at a fulfillment center. She worked at McDonald's behind the counter. And she also worked at a call center called Convergys. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we particularly want to hear from our listeners who have worked these kinds of jobs. We want your experience. Stay with us. Much more after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Emily Gindelsberger about low-wage work, about the three jobs that she held in order to write her new book called On the Clock. Let me read a comment from Beth. She says, I worked under similar circumstances at an Amazon fulfillment center and really enjoyed it. I liked the exercise. I enjoyed glancing at the books and the merchandise. I worked mostly alone and enjoyed the solitude. And then she talks about working in the restaurant world for 2 decades and really liked that work as well. And she ends by saying, I guess it's all in how you look at it. Were there people at Amazon, as you said, that seems like the turnover was, you know, pretty constant, but the people who like that kind of work?
Oh, there absolutely were. Like, everyone I talked to, like, sort of shuddered when talking about working in fast food and retail, because at Amazon, the hours are pretty regular. Right. Like, and so you can plan your life in a way that you can't when you're working food service and retail. Like, that was definitely seen as a positive. The benefits, I haven't really researched that, but mm-hmm. people said that they were pretty good. And, yeah, like, there were people who I talked to who were into it, but not that many who had been there more than a year.
Dan says the kind of work she's describing is nothing new. 100 years ago, people worked on assembly lines with harsh foremen. There was one cure-all, the union movement, he says with an exclamation point.
Yeah. So the book actually gets a lot into sort of the history of exactly that, sort of how it started in the mid 1880s with a guy called Frederick Taylor.
A Philadelphian.
A Philadelphian actually buried in Laurel Hill Cemetery. Oh, it's hard to find his grave, though.
Did you go looking?
I did. just to, you know, pay my respects. He was a weird and interesting man. But so he was sort of the first one to really start timing things. And that was actually because of an advance in technology at the time, which was stopwatches that were accurate and, you know, affordable to non-royalty. So that was his sort of, that was his thing. He would time the best people and
going in the factory, right?
In the factory, going as fast as they can at every task. And then he calls it scientific management. It did not actually seem to be that scientific when you got down to it. When you actually read his stuff, he seems to be pretty arbitrary about, you know, getting from that everybody working as fast as they possibly can to what the average worker should be expected to do in on average day. But it worked incredibly well. Like, production doubled and tripled at factories that he applied his methods to. And yeah, Ford did the same thing with the assembly line that removed even more control of the pace of work. Mm-hmm. But now, like, so you had, you know, a stopwatch, and then you had an assembly line. But now, like, think of that jump forward in technology to, like, iPhones and the internet.
GPS tracking.
Like, it's incredible how it's the same principle, but it's just applied using an incredibly advanced amount of technology.
But as you say, workers, especially that worked under this Taylorism, they hated it.
Yeah, they called him a Speedy Taylor.
Speedy Taylor, because obviously taking your best workers and then saying this is the productivity that we want from everyone else.
Yeah, there was a sort of story that Taylor put in his book. It's called The Story of Schmidt, and it was about this Pennsylvania Dutchman who I found a picture of him, kind of a hottie. it was pretty funny. So he was this 28-year-old guy, and Taylor writes his dialogue all in a dumb accent, and he was kind of the only person at first who was actually able to keep up with Taylor's ideas of how fast people should be working. So he used that guy as an example of, like, the average worker, but almost nobody could actually keep up. Like, he had people volunteer for shifts to be, you know, paid by the giant piece of iron that they moved. But, you know, most of them tried to go back to their original jobs and weren't allowed to and got fired. So, I mean, now you can track every single part of a task, like, subdivided to the extreme with, you know, incredible technology. And it is the idea that workers, if given any leeway at all, will just screw around and go slow and, you know, otherwise be lazy. But right now we're at the point where technology is so good that any downtime means, like, oh, they're being lazy, when it just means that, you know, you're being a human being.
This is about control and productivity. And you write about Ray Kroc with McDonald's, and he famously said, if there's time to lean, there's time to clean. The idea that you're you know, you should be working 24/7 while you're on the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... So Ray Kroc, like, when he originally put out the when he originally, like, sort of started franchising McDonald's out and making it a big deal, there were only three food items on the menu, and it was a hamburger, a cheeseburger, and fries. And you got what you were handed. You didn't get to make a special order or whatever. And so that kind of makes sense because he modeled it after Ford's assembly lines, right? So it was just, you know, people flipping burgers and like assembling the exact same thing over and over again. But now every fast food place, there's like, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of items on the McDonald's menu. And everybody, like a lot of people make special orders, but they still seem to expect that the food should come out as if it's rolling off an assembly line. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the reason behind a lot of people getting super angry.
Was that the most stressful of those three jobs for you?
No, I actually didn't mind McDonald's that much. It was very tiring, and someone did throw honey mustard at me, which was cool. But
apparently that's a common thing, right?
Yes, that was like a lot of people. I lost my temper at this woman who and I yelled at her and got written up for it later. But a lot of my coworkers, like, I guess had heard about me losing my temper and like kind of were like, oh, my God, tell me what happened. Like, what, like, I'm so sorry.
That, right?
That's terrible. But yeah. And so, like, I definitely was the weird one for that being the first time that that had happened to me.
Huh.
And also, like, when I was working at the call center, we were doing an orientation and our manager, our trainer asked us, everyone who has worked fast food, to raise their hands, because I think the question was like, is this, I've heard that this is like people yell at you and they're mean to you. And what she said was, all right, everybody here, like most people in the class raised their hands. They had worked fast food. And then she's like, how many of you have had a customer, you know, get up in your face, like yell at you, throw something at you? And just everybody's hand was still up,
wow.
Which like really surprised me at the time because I hadn't gone to work at McDonald's yet.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. We've got Matt from, looks like Emmaus. And Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Hi there. I just wanted to comment on the ideal that, you know, with the algorithms and things that are being used now. I used to manage a McDonald's years ago. And we, with the algorithms, we've kind of taken the human factor out of it and the human choice out of it. And even then, it was hard. But now you have a computer telling you when to cut people and when, you know, when to schedule people based on profit and loss. And, you know, when you do that based on what a computer tells you, and then all of a sudden you have a rush, you know, you're now put at a disadvantage because now you've cut somebody that could have been there to help. And And, you know, it's understandable that, you know, there's a lot of stress in these jobs now because, you know, we've taken the human factor out of it and put all these algorithms into it.
Very interesting, Matt. Yeah, our guest wants to respond. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, just because I feel like a lot of people don't know what it means, would you mind defining when you cut somebody? What do you do?
Matt?
Well, essentially, yeah. So essentially, you know, you're looking at your basis of how many people you have on staff. And how basically what your burn rate is. So I'm paying so many X amount of people on staff, but I have so much money coming in. And if those profit and losses do not balance, you have to send someone home. So basically, you're cutting someone's hours that you've told that, hey, we want you to work this, but now you know they're depending on that time. And then now you're saying, well, I'm sorry, I can't allow you to work anymore.
Well, is that the answer you were looking for, Emily?
Yeah, that was what I was looking for. I just like to, I don't know, it makes more sense coming out of your mouth, honestly.
Matt, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. I mean, it sounds like he, as a manager's perspective, he saw what you saw.
Yeah, because that's how sort of Taylorism and just this taking control and agency away from workers, like it has crept up into lower management too. Like it, yeah, like
they're under the gun too, right?
Yeah, they're definitely under the gun. Their metrics are, you know, just as hard as yours. And one of them is, you know, if you, your labor costs, if your labor costs outweigh the, you know, money you brought in. So yeah, it's really difficult, especially for people who are, you know, trying to plan their budget and their, you know, schedule, and all of a sudden either are getting called in for a rush or are getting cut when it's slow.
That's Emily Gindelsberger, our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new book. In fact, it's out today. It's called On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And if you're just joining us, Emily worked at an Amazon fulfillment center. She worked at a call center called Convergys, and she worked at McDonald's in downtown San Francisco. You had a piece in Vox where you say, according to a 2015 survey of thousands of U.S. fast food employees by the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, 79% of industry workers had been burned on the job in the previous year, most more than once. You were burned on the job, too, at McDonald's in San Francisco.
I was. If the readers are extremely online, they might remember a Szechuan sauce day. Yeah.
Vaguely, right. You better describe, though, for those of us not
okay.
in the know.
So there's this cartoon called Rick and Morty that a lot of very opinionated people really enjoy. And the season premiere that year involved, I don't know, some sort of time machine going back in time to find this stupid dipping sauce that was like a promotional material for the original Mulan movie.
It's, Lordy.
It's extremely obscure. And that was the joke. They never mentioned it again in the entire season. But McDonald's, somebody over there was like, why don't we just like have a special Szechuan sauce day? We'll, you know. So they gave like 20 packets of this stupid Szechuan sauce out to not all restaurants, but some of them. And
including the one you were at,
not the one I was at,
gotcha.
But that did not stop people from coming in and, getting mad that we didn't have it,
that you didn't have this Szechuan's.
Yeah.
Special Szechuan
it just
sauce.
Made, it was, oh, it was such a miserable day. It like, we were just slammed all day because, you know, there were people in line who would come in and, you know, wait in line for 15 minutes because, you know, we were so overburdened. And then they'd get to the counter and learn we didn't have Szechuan sauce. And then they would be really mad. somebody even, literally accused me of, hiding Szechuan sauce, stashing it away so that I could sell it.
Wow.
It was really bizarre. But anyway, so we were slammed all day. And, we were so slammed that, my McDonald's had four things of hot coffee, right? And something you always want to keep an eye on is how much coffee you have.
Sure.
Because it takes a few minutes to brew a new pot. And if you run out, you're really screwed. So I got in the habit of just sort of picking up each pot briefly just to see how much was left in each one whenever I walked by it. And I did that, and the handle on the thing somehow twisted and it cut my finger pretty bad. And the coffee got all over my pants, and it would. And they keep their coffee incredibly hot.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, they still keep it at the same temperature when that poor woman got burned.
And she sued them, too, didn't she?
Yeah, that one, it's kind of a shame that, you know, got held up. You know, it's still held up as, the dumbest kind of lawsuit. You know, spilling coffee on yourself. But, all right, so this is how that actually happened. All right, so there's this, old woman. She's, I believe she was, her name was Stella Liebeck. I believe she was 79 years old, and she was sitting in the passenger seat, and her grandson was driving her around to do errands. So McDonald's keeps its coffee at about, I believe it was, between 180 and 190 degrees.
That's hot.
It's really hot because, any food above about 140 will burn you. They keep their coffee that hot, apparently because it gives it a longer, shelf life when it tastes good. I'm not entirely clear on that, but they keep it at that temperature. And so there were no cup holders in the car. She was going to put in cream and sugar, and she held it between her knees, and it broke, and it got all over her, and she had just horrible third-degree burn, or,
There were terrible burns.
There were terrible burns. Right. And she had to spend 2 years getting skin grafts and stuff. And she wanted to get just to cover the medical expenses and the time her daughter had to take off work. But then McDonald's wouldn't do it. So they sued and they awarded her this $3 million award, which later got taken down to much less than that.
Right. Let me read a comment from Claudia. She says, I worked for Amazon for 2 weeks in 2011. I was hired as a packer. Two things. When they hired us, they never told us that overtime was mandatory. Come the day before Thanksgiving, we were told we had to work overtime. I presented the doctor's note. I was called off the line. I was fired. I was to retrieve my belongings and go. Unfortunately, I patronize Amazon. I give the people who hang in there and work for them a lot of credit. It's a sweatshop. They're slave drivers. No other way to describe the environment there. One of the questions that got raised, I noticed on our Facebook page, was I'm never going to order another thing from Amazon because of the working conditions there. Is that your advice? Is that a takeaway?
That is not the point that I usually try to make. I don't believe that societal change is really affected by just consumer choice. Also, people are really broke right now and they're really starved for time. I completely understand why, a new parent would get all their diapers delivered, right? And it is kind of, I think, a self-defeating idea to try to ask people to do something that's really against their own self-interest in this general boycott sort of thing. I mean, if you personally feel bad mm-hmm. or guilty about it, you do you. But what we actually need is, government stuff. We need regulations on this sort of thing. We need unions. We need,
So if workers at, say, an Amazon fulfillment center or at McDonald's or this call center where you work, if they were paid, let's say, $25 an hour, would that, in a sense, resolve some of the stress issues that you found there?
I think $25 an hour? Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that would resolve. Because the other half of the stress thing is how stressful your life at home is. When I was at the call center, if you had a bad call, you'd be in a bad mood and really jumpy and stressed out all day. It wasn't, your work kind of followed you home, even though you did not necessarily. And at Amazon, I would get home and I just would fall asleep at 7.
You were that tired.
Yes, I was that tired.
Well, let's take another break and we'll get back to our conversation talking with Emily Gindelsberger about the job she had working at some low-wage work. And her new book is called On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. Lines open 1-888-477-9499, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and we'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Emily Gindelsberger, and we are talking about the workers in this country that don't get talked about when the discussion is about the stock market or the state of the economy, that there are sizable portions and percentages of the population that are really struggling to make ends meet, many of them working at low-wage jobs. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You spent time with a family, you use pseudonyms in the book, but a family that had a young child working these jobs and trying to manage the scheduling, the income, getting their child to either work or childcare in order to sort of keep the family unit going.
Yeah, I think that is one thing that I need to make real clear about the book is that I had it much easier than almost all of my coworkers. I'm, comparatively young and strong and I don't have any children to have to support while I on these salaries. We were talking right before the break about if $25 an hour right. would help. And the reason it would really help is that especially when I was living with Jess and Antoine, the amount of their free time, the parts of their actual life that they traded away just to stay afloat really are, it was something that a lot of people do, and it's something that I don't think gets really recognized that much.
And they both have low-wage jobs.
They both worked with me at Convergys.
Right.
And so, for example, like, just because they would have had to make more money to afford to put their daughter in daycare, they would, so Jess would wake up at, like, 4 most days, or 5, and she would drive 45 minutes to her parents' house and drop her daughter off, and then drive 45 minutes back and give the hand the car off to Antoine, because they work different shifts, and then she would get a ride to work with me. And, like, that's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Like, you're, it's not exactly working, but it is saving money, and I sort of regard it as the same thing. You're trading your time for money. And it was just so exhausting. I didn't even realize it for about a week that she was getting up this early all the time. And that, what? So the, when you say $25 an hour, like, people who are affluent, like people who, a lot of people who have white collar jobs, they're able to sort of buy their way out of the weeds by, you know, having daycare that's close to your house, being able to afford a place that's near your job so you don't have to, like, spend an hour driving all the time. Like, there's, or, like, hiring a maid if you're very affluent. You sort of, like, can buy your time back. But, and it's pretty cheap, but, like, that also means that selling your time away is also not very well paid.
So this notion of time and money, I mean, how linked they are to each other when talking about this kind of work. Let me read some more comments, and we got some callers as well. Amy says, does your guest support legislation like Philadelphia's that regulates scheduling of workers? This is relatively new legislation. Helen Gim shepherding this in Philadelphia, city councilwoman.
Yeah, I was so happy that passed. I believe it was that you have to give more advance notice to workers when you're – I think it's – in San Francisco, they had sort of similar legislation, although that's really not that common in outside of, like, right, big cities. But, yeah, like, you were supposed to get your schedule, like, 2 weeks in advance. And that makes such a difference when you're trying to, like, do – arrange for childcare or, like, I don't know, plan anything,
sure,
anything at all.
Sure. And interestingly, in, because you worked at the McDonald's in San Francisco, they were required to pay you, what, $15 an hour? That was the city regulation.
Yeah, I got $14 an hour, actually, because it was like a, you know, a dollar a increase every, I don't know, 6 months or something.
Right.
But yeah, I think by now it is $15 an hour. But given how expensive rent is, that really doesn't make that much of a difference if you're trying to, like, I was probably a 40-minute train ride from my work, like, way out in Oakland, almost at Berkeley, and most people I worked with lived even farther away than that.
Wow. You said that, I don't know if you still love chicken McNuggets, but that as a young, yes, you do, you say with a big grin.
The people ask me all the time, like, oh, do you not eat McDonald's anymore? No, I love McDonald's. It's delicious, whatever.
Used as a reward growing up, right?
I did,
like many parents.
Yeah, like, I had a lot of surgeries when I was a kid on my legs, and that was sort of like my reward, I guess, or my parents felt bad, so they would give me, you know, McDonald's because it made me feel a little better. And that's still something that I do for myself.
When you give yourself a treat.
Yeah.
Do you order from Amazon?
My husband does. I do when I can't find it locally, but yeah, like, I just bought a nice microphone that was not available at Best Buy, right? But I try not to rely on it at all. I try to, you know, do my shopping in Philadelphia.
Well, I mean, it is transforming retail.
It is.
I mean, the fact that you can get anything, it seems.
Yeah, it's honestly, that's one of the reasons that I picked Amazon, because it's, you know, kind of the apex predator of warehousing, and their logistics system is incredible, and it's what everybody else is trying to be, but they just aren't really that good at it yet. But the reason I picked Amazon is because warehousing jobs have been like on this huge increase over the past 10 years, and retail jobs have not. They've been pretty static. And like, if you want the future of work, like, it's not retail, it's warehousing and logistics.
I wonder whether the future of work is, in a sense, robots doing what you and other workers did at Amazon, whether they will, in a sense, be able to take over the kind of backbreaking work.
I think they're not going to be able to do it for a while, although Amazon is trying super hard. I visited with an Inquirer reporter. I went to one of the, I believe it was in West Deptford, New Jersey. So we went, and it was a, they have generations of fulfillment centers, right? And so mine was built in 2014, the one that I worked at. And this one was, I believe, built last year. So it incorporates robots, which mine did not. And so picking there is a stationary activity. You stand all day, although you still have to like squat and climb up step ladders. But these robots, there's all these shelves out there, and it picks it up, and it looks kind of like a Roomba that's real big, and it picks up a shelf and it puts it directly in front of the worker. But
then they pull whatever off the
shelf?
Yeah,
because the things that robots still are pretty far away from being as good as humans at are, like, visual perception and pattern recognition and fine motor skills. So right now, we're still better at it, but we also, you know, get bored and get sick and get tired and, you know, have to call out because your kid's, you know, misbehaving at school.
Let me get some callers, and we've got Harry calling us from Philadelphia. And Harry, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. There we go. Hi, Harry. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling to contribute to the conversation. And in regards to Uber and Lyft drivers in the Philadelphia region, it's becoming so dangerous because these drivers are driving. Most of them have both apps, and they're driving over 22, 23 hours. So they're falling asleep on the steering. They're having accidents only because they're still struggling to make ends meet. And even if you go to the airport parking lot, you see that drivers spend the night in their cars. Hmm. They're sleeping over there because after driving, they're so tired to even go to their homes. So they spend the night over there, and, you know, it's just dangerous. It's not only dangerous for the driver. It's a public safety issue now.
Well, Harry, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times. And in fact, you called the right place because Emily worked for a while as an Uber driver. She wanted to understand, get to the bottom of this idea that Uber drivers are making $90,000 a year, and this was a great job. And she kind of put that to rest.
Yeah, the $90,000 a year what seemed really off to me, but it was really hard to fact check because you need to, like, think about the depreciation in your car and, like, gas. And a lot of the drivers that I talked to really didn't even keep track of that back in 2015 when I was writing this and doing the research for it. So I figured I'd just try to do it myself, and I would keep, like, meticulous records, and that way I would know that my data was right. I haven't really been keeping up with it other than, you know, every time I get in a Lyft, I will chat up the driver
to find out
I do it every once in a while just to keep on top of things.
I mean, Harry's talking about people working so hard, they're sleeping in their car, and he's worried.
I mean, a lot of the drivers I talked to, particularly immigrants, were working, you know, 80 hours a week. I talked to someone who was working 100 hours a week, which, again, it's not really safe. And that's also not humane. That's pretty bad.
Yeah. And they're not making $90,000.
They are not.
I can say that.
Yeah, from my data, it might be different now, but I made generally between $9 and $10 an hour.
Let me see what Helen from Allentown has to say. And Helen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I called in because I work a retail job. I drive an hour and a half each way just because the job I have has far better benefits than I would get at most other jobs. I know I could make more money, but the benefits just don't match anywhere else with my range.
Well, so far it's worth it for you, Helen?
So far, yeah. I'm about to turn 26, and I have to start paying them on my own. So a very low cost for some good benefits is worth that drive for me every day.
Yeah, I mean, benefit.
But more pay would be nice.
But more pay, more than $12.50 an hour.
I am so sorry that you drive an hour and a half each way. That is horrible. And so that was, it's also kind of what I was talking about earlier, in that, like, people are trading away their lives, like, hours of their time. You know, if you trade away 3 hours of your life every day, like, that's an eighth of your of your day driving, because you can't, I assume, get, like, a job with good benefits where you are. And that's another thing that's kind of overlooked when we talk about, like, how the economy is doing. We don't factor in things like, oh, like, a lot of workers are losing 2 or 3 hours a day just commuting because there's no good jobs where they are.
Does it feel that way for you, Helen?
It does, yes. But I have to do what I have to do, unfortunately, and I think the benefits will hopefully be worth it.
Well, I do, too.
One less stress.
Sure. I appreciate the call, and good luck to you as well. Let me get Mary Ellen from Berks County to join our conversation. And Mary Ellen, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. There we go. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi, thank you. I used to be responsible for call centers worldwide for a couple of Fortune 100 companies. And I would say that one thing that corporations need to take a look at these days is when they're calculating profit loss for some of the decisions that are being made, is to take into account what is happening to their employees. The employees are not disposable, non-living entities that can be treated, I believe, long-term the way that they have been. You've got to be able to take a look at retention cost. A happy employee is going to stay. So what can be done to keep the employee? What kind of decision-making capability have you given them so that they do not feel disempowered when they're behind the phone? Do you do simple things like make sure that they're in a bright, clean environment, that the cafeteria, if there is one, has fresh vegetables and healthy food, things like that?
Well, Mary Ellen, appreciate the call. We really haven't spent a lot of time, Emily, talking about your experience at the call center.
Yeah. Mary Ellen, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
So when you did that, were you directly employed or was it a third party?
I was responsible for both.
Okay.
And we had minimum requirements for some of the third-party vendors that we hired because I was personally measured on both employee satisfaction, profit and loss, as well as customer satisfaction.
Uh-huh. Were you allowed to hang up on people? Were you allowed to get off the phone if they said just horrible things to you?
Yes, I actually had one customer that I called. I had an agent who worked for me that had sexually harassing cartoons faxed to her.
What?
And I had it forwarded to me. I sent it to the HR department for that customer, and I told them that the company that I worked for would no longer do business with them until they apologized to the individual. The individual for that had sent the cartoon in was subsequently terminated, and I have to say it was probably one of the most significant things I've done in my career in terms of gaining the trust of my employees and them feeling like management was behind them.
Yeah, good for that's
Mary Ellen.
Good job.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the call. We're almost out of time here, but Emily, I know you want to respond to her comment.
I do. That was one of the things that I found most difficult out of all of these is that the call center that I worked at, you were not allowed to hang up before the customer did, no matter what they said to you, no matter how much they screamed at you, you just had to take it and apologize and say whatever it took to try to figure out why, you know, just try to calm them down. And that was, like, this customer is always right policy is so dehumanizing sometimes because, like, it's human when somebody, you know, is screaming at you and calling you horrible names to leave, to want to escape that. And not allowing people to escape that is sort of, I don't know, exemplary of this whole treating humans like robots thing.
Well, I hate to end our conversation on that note. To Emily Gindelsberger, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called On the Clock, What Low-Wage Work Did to Me and How It Drives America Insane. We appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times as well. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.